This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. For more than 2 years now, foreign nationals held by the United States at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, have been in legal limbo. The government says these men, most of them picked up in Afghanistan, are enemy combatants detained on foreign soil under the president's authority as commander-in-chief. While the facilities are routinely visited by the Red Cross, the detainees are not accorded the rights of prisoners of war. Only a few of more than 600 have been charged with anything. The rest have no access to lawyers. None have access to American civilian courts. Today, the cases of two detainees were argued before the Supreme Court of the United States. It's the first of three cases the court will hear over the next few weeks that will test the powers of the president in time of war. Later on in the program, terrorism and counterterrorism on the Internet. But first, we'll bring you excerpts from this morning's arguments and analysis. If you have questions about the legal issue, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us first is David Savage, Supreme Court reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He was at the court this morning to hear the arguments. And thanks very much for joining us.
Good to be with you, Neil.
Tell us, first of all, a little bit about the scene. I understand some people stayed on the court steps overnight to see if they could get seats.
Yes, there was quite a crowd outside the court. This happens is a couple times a year when we get a really big case and there's some people brave enough to spend the whole night out there. I fear most of them don't ever get in. The court is not very good about seating people in the public, and there's very few seats. I hope the people who spent the whole night there got in, but I wouldn't be sure.
Well, let's get to the arguments in this case. John Gibbon is the lawyer who represented the prisoners at Guantanamo. If you could encapsulate his argument that he made to the court.
Well, it is an argument that for all of American history, and even in English law, that there's always been the principle of habeas corpus. It sort of goes back to the notion that if the king's men throw you in the dungeon, you could file a writ of habeas corpus, and a judge could say, bring that prisoner before me, to allow the prisoner to say he's innocent, he shouldn't be held. And Gibbon said, American law from the very beginning in 1789 has had the principle of habeas corpus. It refers to prisoners held in the custody of the United States. And he said, based on the right of habeas corpus, these detainees at Guantanamo at least should have the right to go to some court or some judge and say, we're innocent. We were not enemy fighters. And they should be able to chance to have to sort of plead their case.
And indeed, I think he said in the case that was heard by the U.S. District Court of Appeals here in Washington that went before the Supreme Court, he said that Court of Appeals assumed that these people were innocent because they'd not had any hearing at all.
That's right. That's the way it works. You say I'm innocent, and the courts have to sort of assume that. And they say, even if you are innocent, too bad, you don't get a chance to even argue your case.
Now, what about the other side? It was the government was represented by Solicitor General Theodore Olson. What was his argument?
It certainly was a sharply contrasting view of the law. Ted Olson's view was that, first of all, we're at war, that the president is the commander-in-chief, and that it has been understood throughout American history that the president has the power, and his military commanders have the power to pick up people on the battlefield, fighters on the battlefield, and that those people can be held by the military as prisoners, and that those foreign prisoners don't have any right to go into any U.S. court.
Well, let's listen in on some of the arguments, and before we do, we're going to hear some of this tape, but it's going to be, let me just explain ahead of time, some of this is very dense language. They use legal shorthand. We'll do our best to explain it, but I think you'll get the gist of the arguments. So, David Savage, one of the things that they talked about initially was whether this case was being brought, as you mentioned, under habeas corpus, or was it being brought under the Geneva Conventions?
Right.
And the question being, you know, exactly, the several of the justices were trying to argue, what's your case here? What statute are you lying? Are you arguing under?
That's right. They were fishing around trying to get a whole sort of a handle on what the argument is here. Part of the argument is that the habeas corpus statute says it protects you against laws and the Constitution and treaties of the United States. So you could argue that you could make a claim under the Geneva Convention and go to a federal court under the habeas corpus statute. Mr. Gibbons said, we're really saying these people are being held as prisoners. The habeas statute for 215 years has referred to prisoners, and that's good enough. They're prisoners, and they deserve a right to a hearing.
And then one of the key questions being, well, actually, whether they're being held under foreign soil on Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, or whether Guantanamo Bay, Cuba is in fact under the jurisdiction, to all intents and purposes, of the United States. We're going to listen to an excerpt now of Justice Antonin Scalia addressing the attorney for the detainees, John Gibbons, about specific language regarding the treaty about Guantanamo Bay.
Mr. Gibbon, I'm quoting from page 8 of the government's brief, which I assume is an accurate quote of the treaty. It doesn't just say that Cuba has sovereignty if we give up the lease. It says the United States, this is the treaty, recognizes the continuance of the ultimate sovereignty of the Republic of Cuba over the leased area. Now, I take that to mean that they are sovereign even during the term of the lease.
Now may
you
say,
it's artificial, but there it is.
It's
the law of land, as you say.
I misspoke, Justice Scalia, by omitting the reference to continuing. But it doesn't make any difference. The reference in the lease meant that Cuban law somehow applied in the United States Navy base at Guantanamo Bay. That would be one thing. But Cuban law has never had any application inside that base. A stamp with Fidel Castro's picture on it wouldn't get a letter off the base.
And again, that's an exchange between Justice Antonin Scalia and John Gibbon, who's representing the detainees on Guantanamo Bay. David Savage, just before that, I think Gibbon said, look, if one detainee attacked another one, the only law they could be charged under is American law. Otherwise, there would be no law at all in Guantanamo Bay.
Yeah, that's right. As a matter of just sort of common sense, the people who go to Guantanamo, it's an American naval base. It's American law. It's been run by the Navy for 100 years. The government can say yes, but it's still part of Cuban sovereign territory. In the end, I don't know that this will be a decisive issue, but it is an interesting, tricky one, because the reason it's important is that if you or I were picked up by the government and held in U.S. territory, everybody would agree that the Constitution would apply to us. It says no person may be denied the rights to due process of law. However, if you and I were picked up by somebody in Guatemala or Canada or whatever, the Constitution wouldn't apply. So a lot of the argument here over what is Guantanamo Bay and what's the sovereignty sort of turns on this issue of whether U.S. law applies there.
And it came up again. Here's an exchange between Justice Breyer and Solicitor General Ted Olson. Justice Breyer is sort of repeating the Solicitor General's argument to him.
If we go with you, it has the virtue of clarity. There is a clear rule. Not a citizen outside the United States, you don't get your foot in the door. But against you is that same fact. It seems rather contrary to an idea of a constitution with three branches that the executive would be free to do whatever they want without a check. That's problem one. Problem two is that we have several hundred years of British history where the cases interpreting habeas corpus said to the contrary anyway. And then we have the possibility of really helping you with what you're really worried about, which is undue court interference, by shaping the substantive right to deal with all those problems of the military that led you to begin your talk by reminding us of those problems. So if it's that choice, why not say, sure, you get your foot in the door, prisoners in Guantanamo, and we'll use the substantive rights to work out something that's protective but practical.
David Savage, Justice Breyer there, talking with Theodore Olson, whose voice we didn't hear in that particular excerpt, but he's talking about which branch of the government has jurisdiction here. Is it only the executive branch?
Yes, I thought that was a really interesting exchange. Breyer tends to do that. This is a later part of the argument. He sort of sums up the position of where everybody is, and I thought he was laying out a really interesting view, which is that he was sort of saying to Olson, you're arguing this stiff position that these people have no rights under the law at all. And that has the virtue of being clear, but it seems like it goes way too far, I think, for too far for five members of the court. I think Breyer is trying to say, is likely to say, we're going to say there's some jurisdiction here. These prisoners are entitled to some rights, but don't get too worried, because we're also then, we may write an opinion that says they have a right to, let's say, a hearing before a military court, and that's all. They don't have a right to go to U.S. court in Miami, but these men deserve some chance before some judge or some court to argue their case. And I think Breyer was trying to say, trying to find a middle ground position, which is these men are entitled to some rights, but not an unlimited right to sort of go into the U.S. courts in Washington or Miami.
Mm-hmm. And here's another exchange, this between the Solicitor General Theodore Olson and Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, where she mentions an interesting concept, sort of the slippery slope argument. Let's listen in.
To the extent that what the petitioners are seeking is to oversee the this is the language in their brief, to oversee the circumstances of detention, that is going to vary from case to case.
General Olson, I've looked at the reply brief, which is their last chance to say what they mean, and they say we're not asking for any of those things, and certainly not asking to have a lawyer there while these people are being interrogated. They are saying, look, we are claiming that our people are innocents, and for purposes of this proceeding, we must assume that. And all we want is some process to determine whether they are indeed innocent. And it doesn't have to be a court process.
But Justice Ginsburg, the relief that I was articulating is what they asked for in the first instance. If they have jurisdiction in this court, the next petitioner doesn't have to say, well, I only want a process.
And there's the slippery slope. If you give these guys some rights, give them an inch, they'll take a mile.
Yes, that's right. Ginsburg, I think, was picking up on Breyer's point that they're not asking for much. We can give them some process. And as you say, Ted Olson is saying it won't stop there. If once they get that, they'll ask for a lot more.
Well, given the narrow focus of this case, what would the detainees win if they go ahead and win?
That's a very good question, Neil. I think it's the really hard one to answer after this argument. My sense is that the detainees are going to win something here. I think five justices, maybe six, are inclined to say they get some hearing, some due process of law. But then it's a real struggle to say what it is and how far it goes, exactly illustrated by that exchange. You remember Justice Ginsburg said they should get some process. It may not even be a court hearing. And so that's why I say I think if I had to guess, they're going to try to write an opinion that says these people deserve some chance to plead their innocence, some right to be heard, but that the government and the military could solve this if they would just give them a hearing, say, before a military judge down in Guantanamo.
And that's an impression from listening to today's arguments, an overwhelming majority of the court, do you think?
No. I'd say the four more liberal justices, Justices Stevens, Souter, Breyer, and Ginsburg, are definitely inclined to lean against the government. In favor of the government, the Chief Justice Rehnquist, Justice Scalia, and almost surely Justice Thomas. We always watch Sandra Day O'Connor and Anthony Kennedy because they're in the middle. And both of them seemed a little troubled. Kennedy made the point that the habeas corpus statute refers to prisoners. It doesn't really have any limit on it. He seemed to say the law gives everyone this right. And O'Connor made a similar comment where she seemed to think that the government was really the no rights, no process. Whatever due process means, it means some process, and the government can't give them nothing. So just a guess, but I think five or six of them will lean against the government.
David Savage, stay with us. We'll put this in the context of the other two cases that are up before the Supreme Court when we come back from a break. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing this morning's arguments before the Supreme Court regarding the legality of holding so-called enemy combatants at the Guantanamo U.S. Naval Base. A little later on, we'll talk with a presidential historian about the history of presidential powers during wartime. Of course, you're invited to join the discussion. If you have questions about how this case could affect the 600-plus prisoners in Guantanamo or about the history of presidential powers during war, give us a call at 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or email us, TOTN at NPR.org. Right now, we're talking with David Savage. He's a Supreme Court reporter for the Los Angeles Times. And David, we heard a summary of the arguments this morning, but this is just one of three cases, national security cases, coming up before the Supreme Court in the coming days. Tell us about the other two and how they all fit together.
Well, the two next week involve American citizens. These, you know, the Guantanamo detainees are all foreigners. They have two cases next week of two American citizens, Yasser Hamdi, who was an American citizen who was picked up in Afghanistan and brought back to the U.S. and is now being held in a brig in Charleston, and Jose Padilla, who is an American citizen who was arrested at Chicago's O'Hare Airport on a flight returning from Pakistan. And that's the government has taken, the Bush administration has basically taken the same position in those cases that they have done with the Guantanamo detainees, which is even though they're American citizens, they can be, the president can deem them as illegal enemy combatants. They can be held in a military brig with no right to see a lawyer, no right to speak to their families, no charges, and no hearing and no trial. So the court's going to take on two of those on one day next week to consider whether the, again, whether the president has gone too far.
And those men have been allowed to see attorneys, but as a matter of privilege, according to the government, not as a matter of right.
Yes, you're absolutely right. At the time the cases were appealed, they hadn't seen their attorneys, but then the government allowed to see them allowed them to see lawyers recently.
Well, David Savage, we know you're on deadline for your own paper. Thanks very much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Glad to be with you now.
David Savage is the Supreme Court reporter for the Los Angeles Times and was with us from his office here in Washington, D.C. Joining us now are two guests with whom we've discussed the Guantanamo prisoners' cases in the past. Eugene Fidel is president of the National Institute of Military Justice. He's with us from his office here in Washington. Good to have you back on the program.
Nice to be back, Neil.
And Robert Turner, co-founder and associate director of the Center for National Security Law at the University of Virginia. He's with us from his office in Charlottesville, and thanks to you as well.
Glad to be here, Neil.
Eugene Fidel, based on what we've heard from David Savage of the Los Angeles Times, what's your impression of the arguments before the court today?
Well, first of all, I think what occurred was some masterly advocacy by two of the country's great lawyers, and the Supreme Court at its best. This is the reason we have a multi-member highest court. We don't just have a court of one justice. And you see the interchange of ideas and people challenging one another and pressing the argument. It's a great institution that does this in public, and a very impressive display of really the crown jewel of our legal system.
And those of us in broadcast thank them for their new practice of releasing audio tapes on a prompt basis, which enables us to do this program in a much more interesting basis today. Robert Turner, what did you make of the arguments this morning?
Well, I share Gene's views that it's a good thing to have happen, and it's the best of the business. I'm a little troubled that there is not enough distinction between the concept of prisoners and the concept of detainees, because under international law, prisoners of war, unless or until they're accused of criminal behavior, are not viewed as wrongdoers or prisoners, and indeed it's a violation of international law to hold them in a penitentiary or a prison. The theory is they are honorable soldiers from the other side. They have been captured by the their enemy. Rather than allowing their enemy to, or giving them an incentive to kill them, we say hold them for the duration of the war and then let them go. We had hundreds of thousands of German POWs held in the United States during World War II. Not one of them got a judicial hearing. When we had hundreds of American POWs in Vietnam starting in 64 and going until January of 73. Again, we complained when they were tortured, but not once did we say they were entitled to an attorney or a day in court. I think it's confusing two very different processes.
If I can chime in on that.
Go ahead, Eugene Fidel.
Never say there wasn't one.
I think actually, you're right. I think there were two or three unique cases.
But Bob Turner knows what I'm about to say. There was a case in World War II where a U.S. citizen named Torito, who had been captured, I believe, in Sicily, on or near the battlefield, and became a POW in California, actually sued out of habeas corpus, and he got a trial, and he got full-tilt judicial review. He ultimately remained a POW, but the courthouse door was open to him. The question is whether his case is distinguishable from the current cases, and obviously there are grounds of distinction, just as there are grounds of distinction between the cases of the detainees at Guantanamo Bay and the cases of the German convicts who were the litigants in a case called Johnson against Eisentrager, which is the lead case from 1950 that the justices were struggling with today.
Well, let's get some listeners involved, 800-989-8255, and we'll begin with Josh, who joins us from San Francisco.
Yeah, hi. Something's been bothering me about this very term, enemy combatant. This category, enemy combatant, does it appear in any international treaty or convention regarding the rules of warfare, for example, the category of prisoner of war certainly does, and the enumeration of the rights of prisoner of war does, or is this category, enemy combatant, essentially woven, invented out of whole cloth by our administration precisely in order to sidestep and evade our legal obligations under the Geneva Convention and other international treaties?
Well, let's get a response from Robert Turner.
It's certainly not a new concept, and indeed the Supreme Court in the Quirin case talked about lawful combatants and unlawful combatants, and noting that lawful combatants have what's often referred to as a combatant's privilege, or you know, it's not an illegal act for a soldier to kill an enemy soldier in combat, but for a non-soldier or someone, you know, say a terrorist, to do so is a wrongful act, so this is certainly not a new concept. It's been around for many years and has been discussed generations ago by the Supreme Court.
Well,
Bob's very right on target on that. The question is, what does the term mean? And in answer to the caller's inquiry, it has become freighted in the immediate controversy with a sort of subtext that has some baggage that comes along with it, a judgment that once a person has been had that rubber stamp applied to him or her, certain legal consequences flow from that. And that is one of the things that is at issue both in the case of the Guantanamo detainees and in the other cases that David Savage was discussing that are going to be argued in a few days.
Following up on Josh's point, though, and Josh, by the way, thanks very much for the call. Why are not these detainees in Guantanamo Bay, why are they not prisoners of war under the Geneva Conventions?
Well, on that, the government, the administration took the position early on that for a somewhat complicated set of reasons, neither Taliban personnel, if I can use that term, nor Al-Qaeda people qualified within the meaning of the Third Geneva Convention, the one that governs prisoners of war. And so you have a definitional point that the administration's view was none of these people would qualify. And from that flowed the proposition that, that being the case, there was no need to conduct the screening tribunals that are called for under Article 5 of the Third Geneva Convention.
But so, Robert Turner, basically they're not prisoners of war because the government says they're not.
Well, no, I think it's much more than that. If you look at the language of the Third Geneva Convention on treatment of prisoners of war, the Al-Qaeda clearly is not even arguably covered because they don't. They were not the military force of a sovereign state or a party to the convention, and they don't comply with the rules of armed conflict. The Taliban is a more arguable case, but my own sense is they did not think of themselves as the armed forces of Afghanistan. They did not hold commissions issued by the government of Afghanistan. They were the military arm of a religious faction that had seized control of parts of the country, and indeed the UN Security Council repeatedly refused to recognize the Taliban as a government and referred to it instead as the Afghan faction known as the Taliban. But I think it would be a great – I think that we should have applied, as we are doing, the basic protections of Geneva III to these people. That's not an issue. Whether we should formally call them POWs is an issue. I think we should not, and the reason is – a fundamental distinction between prisoners of war, who are by definition soldiers, and terrorists. I view terrorists as a common enemy of mankind. I view soldiers, whether they're American or Russian or North Vietnamese or Vietnamese, what have you, as honorable people following a very important profession of arms. And to confuse the two, to pretend that terrorists who intentionally attack civilians, are the same thing as soldiers, is an insult to everyone who ever wore a military uniform.
And let's follow up on the question of sovereignty at Guantanamo Bay. This also raised by both sides in the arguments today, obviously with differing opinions. What about other American bases overseas? Are the same kinds of issues? Or as I think even the argument the lawyer for the detainees said today, Guantanamo Bay is pretty unique.
I think that's right. And Guantanamo Bay has a very, very peculiar history. We have effectively a perpetual lease. We could keep it forever because it only reverts, so to speak, to Cuba if both the United States and Cuba agree that we would leave and turn it back over. And, in the past, it's been analogized to the former Panama Canal Zone. Remember that? I don't think there's much trouble that you would find a ruling that the writ of habeas corpus reaches Guantanamo Bay as necessarily implying that the writ of habeas corpus would reach other places in which the U.S. has some modicum of a physical presence, let's say, and may control a small base or, something like that. So I don't think that you have what the justices and the parties were referring to as a slippery slope problem in extending habeas corpus or in permitting habeas corpus to reach Guantanamo Bay. And let me say, interestingly, this is not actually a case of first impression, because in 1986, the highest court of the military, the Court of Military Appeals, as it was then called, actually issued a writ of habeas corpus addressed to the brig officer at Guantanamo Bay. So this is not literally a case of first impression.
But a more relevant precedent, that precedent is true, and it involved a U.S. citizen. Now, a more interesting precedent is when Haitian and Cuban refugees who had been taken by the Coast Guard and the Navy to Guantanamo Bay tried to get access to American courts, and the court said, they're not U.S. citizens, they're not aliens inside this country. They have no Fifth Amendment rights, which is right on point to what we're talking about. Often we have effective sovereign control over territory in other countries. Right now, there are parts of Iraq that our soldiers may well be exercising effective sovereign control over. And if we start saying that foreign nationals, the Supreme Court in Eisentrager explained that the reason we give aliens protections of our Constitution is because we have welcomed them into our country, and by so doing, we owe them certain protections. That's not the case in Guantanamo. The reason they took him to Guantanamo was not to hide from the court, but to put him in a secure place where they could not easily escape or break out or be broken out. Whereas if we'd held him somewhere in the Middle East, there'd be a risk of all sorts of attacks and things. But again, traditionally, foreign prisoners of war, have never been given constitutional rights under the U.S. Constitution. This is for the court to make that decision would not only break new ground, it would raise all sorts of frightening parallels. If, for example, the Constitution guarantees that no enemy combatant can be deprived of his liberty interest without first having a judicial hearing in the United States, it would seem to follow a priori that you can't deprive them of their interest in life. The Fifth Amendment protects not only the right to liberty, but also the right to life, and lists that first. And would that mean that every time a private starts to shoot at a foreign soldier, he would first have to call a timeout and say, let's go before the Ninth Circuit or Federal District Court and have a trial so I can prove that you are an enemy soldier and I have a right to shoot you? And are we going to have hordes of American lawyers running around battlefields trying to find plaintiffs to bring wrongful death suits against American soldiers? It really opens a Pandora's box for the court to depart from established precedents on this.
Well, with that vision dancing in the head to the ABA, we'll leave it there. Robert Turner, thanks very much for your time today.
My pleasure.
Robert Turner with us from his office in Charlottesville, Virginia, co-founder and associate director of the Center for National Security Law at the University of Virginia. Eugene Fidel, thank you for your time today, too.
Thanks, Neil.
Eugene Fidel is president of the National Institute of Military Justice. He was with us from his office here in Washington. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And joining us now is Louis Fisher. He's a senior specialist in separation of powers at the Congressional Research Service. The second edition of his book, Presidential War Power, has just been released. He's with us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
How does Article 2 of the Constitution describe executive powers in times of war?
The president is commander-in-chief, but the framers understood that in terms of any unilateral powers to be the power to repel sudden attacks. Any other type of war would be done by Congress, either through a declaration of war or an authorization of war. And that was the practice from 1789 up to 1950, where we had our first presidential war with Truman going into Korea.
And in this context, and here's an email question on this point from Carrick in Little Rock, Arkansas, does it make any difference under the Geneva Accords that the United States Congress has never declared war in either Afghanistan or Iraq?
No, the Supreme Court in some early cases in 1800 and 1801 made it very clear that Congress has a choice, that it can either be by declaration or by authorization. For example, we went to war against France in 1798. That was called a quasi-war. It was done through a number of authorizing statutes, but no declaration. So Congress has a choice.
And indeed, the majority of American conflicts have been conducted without a declaration of war.
We've only had five major wars where there have been declarations.
And there's been an awful lot of conflicts.
Many.
Yeah. How do we understand the founders' intent regarding the separation of powers in this regard? Is the executive meant to have, in this case, the sole determining authority over the status of people like those being held in Guantanamo?
Well, if the framers had wanted that, they could have borrowed from the British model, both John Locke and William Blackstone, because they would have put all of external affairs, war powers, foreign affairs, in the executive. And obviously, when you read the Constitution, you can see that the president receives none of the powers that Blackstone itemized unilaterally. They're either given exclusively to Congress in Article 1, or they're shared, as with the appointment of ambassadors or with treaties, shared between the president and the Senate. So this president has no unilateral powers other than the power to repel sudden attacks.
And similarly, and very briefly, I'm going to have to ask you, we heard today the argument that the rights of habeas corpus long antedate the Constitution of the United States.
Oh, they go back into British history centuries. And this is the other key idea by the framers was not to have power concentrated because you would lose rights and liberties, but to have power distributed through separation of powers and checks and balances.
We're going to continue our conversation on presidential powers in time of war after we come back from a short break, and we'll take more of your calls at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Or you can email us, TOTN at NPR.org. Our guest is Louis Fisher, a senior specialist in separation of powers at the Congressional Research Service and the author most recently of Presidential War Power. I'm Neil Cohn, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Cohn in Washington. After Supreme Court arguments this morning over the cases of foreign nationals being held at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, we're discussing a series of questions about the presidential powers in time of war. Those are the issues that the Supreme Court will be deciding, not just in that case, but in others coming up next week. Our guest is Louis Fisher, senior specialist in separation of powers at the Congressional Research Service. And Louis Fisher, hasn't there been an historical pattern that in times of war, the executive, the president, extends his powers under the Constitution, and then sometimes after the conflict is over, Congress, the pendulum swings the other way, and Congress reasserts its authority?
That's a certain pattern, but if you look again from that period from 1789 to 1950, the presidents didn't act alone. They either came to Congress for declaration or authorization, and the courts were involved in war power military actions starting in 1800, certainly up to the Steele seizure case of 1952. And the only case I know of where the court ducked it entirely was one after the Civil War, a Mississippi v. Johnson case. So all three branches were participants in war powers. It's only the last 50 years that we've seen presidents claim that they can do it without interference from the other two branches.
Well, give us some examples from the last 50 years, then, of what President Truman would be the first.
Well, Truman was the first. Instead of going to Congress for authority, he went to the UN Security Council for a resolution, two resolutions, to go into Korea on his own. He could have, after the fact, come to Congress for authority, but never did. And we've had in recent years, under presidents, particularly under Clinton and Reagan, a number of actions without any authorization or declaration by Congress.
That would have been Kosovo and Grenada.
Kosovo is the big one. Grenada, certainly sending troops into Bosnia, threatening to invade Haiti. The first Bush going into Panama in 1989. All these done without any legislative authority.
Let's get a question from Bill, who's on the phone with us from Indianapolis.
How you doing?
Very well, thank you.
I remember Professor Fisher's book on executive orders. I read it when I was an undergrad in political science.
And I hope you remember it fondly, but go ahead with your question, Bill.
I wanted to know, can the president, as commander-in-chief, by his own initiative, deny citizens due process of law?
And these would be the next cases coming up.
These would be the two cases for next Tuesday, Hamadi and Padilla.
Exactly. Is there any precedent for that, Professor Fisher?
No, I think this case is next week. We'll look at the statute passed by Congress that you cannot detain citizens without authority by Congress. The executive branch has taken the opposite position, that we can do as we like with Hamdi and Padilla, regardless of what Congress did by statute.
Okay, Bill, thanks for the question. I made you a professor. I don't think you are.
Not right now.
Not at the moment.
No,
but anyway.
No, thank you.
Bill, thanks very much for the call. And finally, where is Congress in this? If they have authority under the Constitution, don't they have to exercise it?
That's the problem, that the framers assumed that each branch would fight off encroachments, and what we've seen for the last 50 years, that the power has gone to the president and Congress has not reacted to protect itself. And we've seen that in recent years, where Congress should be holding hearings on matters such as military tribunals. They have the lion's share of power over the military, and Congress has not been doing it. Congress is losing a sense of itself as a separate institution, as a separate body, and part of the checks and balances.
Louis Fisher, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Louis Fisher is the author of Presidential War Power, a senior specialist in separation of powers at Congressional Research Service. He was with us here in Studio 3A.